Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States, and in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on freedom of speech when we come back. You know, during the 1970s, an obscure black college professor at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, while working on a grant, developed a unique marketing plan for agricultural products. And the plan was aimed at poor, rural, black landowners in the South who owned small acreages. Now, his goal was to keep these landowners on the land by producing produce for sale to the public at retail and to generate an income that would support a family. It was called the Whatley Program. And the Whatley Program was so successful that it became known as the Whatley Program, How to Make $100,000 per year on 25 acres or less. And that man's name was Professor Booker T. Whatley. Now, there are more than 4,000 of these small family enterprises operating here in the United States. And the law school has taken the Whatley Program and added the 15 agricultural laws of the Bible and the 17 financial laws from the Bible as well, so that we can practice all of the laws of the United States, all of the laws of our states, and the scripture, and then make a good living for you and your family all at the same time. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our $100,000 class is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and then click on to the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. I want you to do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we've been talking about this thing of freedom of speech. Sometimes I'm asked, well, why do you put people's dissenting opinions in your paperwork when they're running you down? Well, listen to Larry Beecraft's statement here concerning the MCO argument, and then I'll answer that. He goes on to say here, the MCO argument is another crazy idea promoted by people who refuse to perform any research. When a car manufacturer builds a car, that company owns it and has title to it. Title to personal property, like a car, is not some document. It is that invisible bundle of rights which one has when he owns something. And that bundle of rights excludes all other parties from possession of the property in question. And when a car is purchased, the buyer delivers money to the seller and acquires title to the car. And that title means that he can exclude all other persons from possession of that car. And a bill of sale is nothing but a document which evidences the fact that title has passed from one party to another. This bundle of rights can be divided, and this happens when a car is purchased by way of financing provided by a bank or other financial institution. And when this happens, the bank has an interest in the car, and that interest is protected by way of contractual provisions as well as a financial statement called a UCC Form 1, which is filed at a designated state office to show to the rest of the world and the bank that the bank has an interest as a secured party in that vehicle. And if the loan is paid, the bank's interest is extinguished. If not, it can claim possession of the car. Certificates of title are nothing but the state's answer to the problem of car theft. Certificate means, according to Black's Law Dictionary, a written assurance or official representation that some act has or has not been done, or some event occurred, or some legal formality complied with. States have enacted laws to provide for certificates of title for cars which are issued and given to car owners. They are nothing more than further evidence of ownership of a car, and this helps reduce the incidence of car theft, but such a certificate is not title to a car, and neither is the MCO. Lots of flaky arguments float around this country, and the MCO argument is just simply another one promoted by people who do not know what they're talking about. And that's the end of the story from Larry Beecraft. All right. Now, I have a take on this MCO, and I'm going to present my witnesses, my evidence, and my testimony, and I disagree and I dissent. How do you like that, Larry? I dissent. Part of what Larry Beecraft says is true, and part of what he says is false. And part of what he does not say is a part of the argument also. But that's not to run Larry Beecraft down. Primarily, what he said is true, accurate, and correct, but it isn't the whole story. And the lady that he is correcting, or the lady who sent the letter for which he is making his argument or making his observations, I don't agree with her either. Part of what she says has some merit, and part of what she says doesn't have any merit. And the total conclusion from both Larry Beecraft and the lady is in error. Both of them are in error. The conclusion that they have come to are two errors. That's the bottom line. So there's some more to the story. So I thought what I would do is I would weigh in on the subject matter and let's talk about this MCO. Let's go back and take a look at property and property rights. And let's ask some hard questions about, well, if that's true, then how come this is going on? Or how come so-and-so over here did thus and such, and here was the outcome? Now, you see, in life, there are outcomes. And sometimes people say to me, well, you are anti-this or anti-that or this or that or something else. That's what we call in law assuming facts, not in evidence. I mean, you can come to a conclusion, you can assume that that's true, but it may or may not be. And the purpose for freedom of speech now is to arrive at the truth, or if we don't have the whole truth, we'd like to get as much evidence as possible. It may be when we get through with the subject, we may not have all the answers, but we want to have more answers than we have now. And the answers that we do get or receive, we want to make sure that those answers are closer to the truth or that they're more likely to be the truth than what we now have. So let's take a look and we'll go back from there. The manufacturer's certificate of origin argument. I'm going to go back here and we're going to critique this statement. Larry Beecraft said, I got a letter from an angry lady in Colorado and she made these statements. She starts her letter off. Let's analyze this lady's letter because I disagree with her letter also. But not in whole, but in part. Some of what she says has some merit. Some of what she says has some questions that need to be asked and answered. Let's take a look at it. She starts off, she says, next, the deceitful lawyers, DBA, the state, coerce these dealers into stealing the real bill of sale, called the manufacturer's certificate of origin, and unlawfully converting it into a title, which does not convey lawful ownership of the private car. It's just another little fraud crime that they pull. So I'm going to put a bracket around that, and let's analyze that statement, that paragraph. Some of it's got some merit, and some of it doesn't. She says, the deceitful lawyers, DBA, the state. Lawyers, doing business as the state. Where do these lawyers come in here? I'm not sure that that's true. It is true that lawyers, as a class or a profession of people, are criminals. There's little doubt about that. And it is true that lawyers are not well-liked, and they're spoken in disparagingly and so on. And there's some good reason for that. But that doesn't make every lawyer that draws breath a wicked, evil, terrible, awful ogre. I have a couple of friends, people that I know that are lawyers, that I happen to like. And I think that they're pretty sincere and honest people who are engaged in a deceitful and wicked and evil occupation. But, hell, doctors are doing the same thing. And doctors, you know, that's a criminal occupation. In fact, of the 15 professions mentioned in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, all 15 of them are crimes. In fact, all professions are crimes because all of these professions require a license, and a license is a crime of and by itself. Hell, just look at the definition of it. If you have a license, it's permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. Larry Beecraft's a nice guy. I like him. He has a license to practice law. He's a criminal. How do I know that? He's got a license. Now, I'm sure that he would say, I'm not that kind of a criminal. Well, Richard Nixon said that he wasn't a crook. Well, he wasn't an ordinary kind of crook. I mean, he wasn't breaking into people's houses and robbing them and burglarizing. But that didn't mean that he wasn't a crook. That didn't mean that he wasn't breaking a law. Didn't mean that he wasn't committing a crime. Now, there's a God out there in the universe, and the guy says that he's got some standards over here, and these standards require that you follow the Ten Commandment model. And we don't do that, and so we're criminals. Well, lawyers. Take a look in the Bible at lawyers, and he had a lot to say about lawyers, and he called them everything but white men. He was not happy with lawyers. He wasn't happy with bankers, and he was even less happy with preachers. Now, you know, there's preachers out there. I know a couple of three preachers, nice guys. Hell, all preachers are nice guys, but they're engaged in a criminal enterprise. Criminal activity. How do I know that? They all have licenses. And the definition of a license is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort or a trespass. Boys and girls, torts and trespasses and illegal and unlawful activities are crimes. Let's wake up and smell the coffee here. So when you have a driver's license, you're a criminal. And you intend to break a law. You might not know whose law it is you're breaking. You might not know what law you intend to break. But the mere fact that you have the license is prima facie evidence that you intend to break a law. That's why you got the license. It's the definition of it. It's the purpose behind it. All right? Now, that doesn't mean that the guy that's got the license is necessarily all wicked, evil, terrible, and awful. You know, he's got a viewpoint, and I've got my viewpoint, and I just expressed it. Okay? And he may disagree with me. But I just told you, go look up the definition. I didn't write it. Hell, I used to have licenses. Had a lot of them. And then one day I woke up and I said, well, why do I want this license? Well, I want to do this activity. I want to participate in this crime. I want to commit this crime, and I don't want to pay any penalties. And so I go out and I get a license so that I can commit a crime without paying any penalties. I want to be licensed to do this crime. So Beecraft comes back here now and he says, hey, listen, this manufacturer certificate of origin argument over here, here's my opinion on it. This guy's a lawyer. He's got a position. He has a viewpoint which is impressed upon his mind based upon all of his five senses and all of his experiences in life. But Larry Beecraft hasn't had the same experiences that I've had. So he doesn't know what I know. And I know a little something too. But in this first paragraph here, I'm going to agree with Larry's observation. Next to the deceitful lawyers, DBA, the state, coerce these dealers. The state is coercing the automobile dealers into stealing the real bill of sale? Oh, I don't believe that for a minute. I don't think that your Chevrolet dealer is being coerced by any lawyers or the state to steal the real bill of sale. That's a conclusion that this lady has drawn based upon her experience in life, based upon what she knows, what she's seen. You got five senses here, children. You can see, hear, taste, touch, and smell. And every opinion that you have in your brain came from one or more of those five senses. And if it wasn't for that, you wouldn't know it. Save for revelation. This could have been revealed to you. Now, if you got it by revelation, then how do you know the revelator was telling you the truth? See, you don't know that either until you've experienced it or until you've tested it. That's called the scientific principle. Now, making a statement here that deceitful lawyers, what in the hell makes you think these lawyers are deceitful? You know, not all lawyers are deceitful. To make a statement that says that next the deceitful lawyers doing business as the state of Colorado have coerced these dealers into stealing the real bill of sale called the manufacturer's certificate of origin. I don't believe that a bill of sale is the manufacturer's certificate of origin. I don't believe that. And Larry Beecraft said he didn't believe it either. And went to some pains here to explain there's three pieces of paper. A bill of sale, a manufacturer's certificate of origin, and a title. And I would agree with Beecraft again that that's true. I don't deny it. Now, this lady is making a statement concerning, she's got a belief concerning this manufacturer's certificate of origin. Beecraft said it's just a piece of paper that's used in commerce. Is it? I don't believe that. I think that manufacturer's certificate of origin is something more than that. And I think I can prove that. I've had some experience with this MCO. So have some of my students. That maybe Mr. Beecraft hasn't had. Not that that's any big deal, you know, not all of us have had the same experience. I used to fly airplanes, not everybody has flown an airplane. So not everybody has had that same experience. Your view of the world, your view of life changes when you become a pilot. Pilots have a different mindset and a different viewpoint than the rest of the people. I know that because before I was a pilot, I had a viewpoint. And after I was a pilot, my viewpoint changed. That's all there is to it. And I'm sure that Mr. Beecraft's viewpoint in life changed after he got out of law school. And your viewpoint changed when you got out of plumbing school. And your viewpoint changes based upon the knowledge that goes into your brain. And if you want to know what you are what your brain is. And your body is just used here to carry your brain around. Your brain is what you are. It's called the heart in the scripture. And the scripture says the heart of man is wicked, deceitful, and evil beyond description. Well, hell, that's not talking about that pump in your chest that's pumping blood around. It's not wicked, evil, and dishonest. It's your mind. And it's that free choice. That's that opinion that you've got, see? All right, so generally speaking, truth exists independently from what you believe. Doesn't have to. I mean, you could have the truth, but generally speaking, there's truth out there that is totally independent from what you and I believe and this lady believes and everybody else. I don't believe that all lawyers are deceitful, and I don't believe that the state is coercing automobile dealers into stealing the real bill of sale, which is called the manufacturer certificate of origin, because I don't think the MCO is the bill of sale. But I do think that the MCO is the title to the automobile. And Larry Beecraft says, I don't believe that the MCO is the title. The title is something else. Well, Beecraft, you're wrong again. We've had this discussion before. And then as Justice Scalia said of Ginsburg, well, she's wrong. That's all. Won't be the first time, and it won't be the last. All right, so now the burden's on me to prove that. See, and I think I can do that. I think I can, as we progress along here, I think I can show you that. But now, I disagree with this lady also. And this lady has come to some conclusion. This is what we call assuming facts, not in evidence. You know? And if you'll take a look at bill of sale in the dictionary and the manufacturer's certificate of origin, and then the title, you'll find that there's three different documents here. But, you know, sometimes a document will serve dual purposes. You can have a document that you call a title, and it can serve more than one purpose. Your body's anatomy is designed that way. God, you know, he was a pretty smart guy. He created your body, and your body can serve more than, you know, body parts. Pieces of your body can serve more than one function. You know, just your ears on your head, you know, your hearing device is not the ear. It's inside your head. It's called your eardrum. We say we hear with our ears. That's not true. The ear directs sound into your eardrum. So the ear is a very important part of your anatomy, but it is not the device that you hear with. In fact, you hear with your mind, and the eardrum itself is a part of the device that causes you to hear. I mean, you know, when you get down, you start analyzing things. We make some broad sweeping statements a lot of the time. And the broad sweeping statement we all take at face value, and we say, okay, we hear with our ears. No, you don't. No, you don't. And I know that's what we say, and I know that's what we believe, but that is not true. You do not hear with your ear, you hear with your mind. It's your brain that hears. Now, in order for your brain to get these sound waves into it so that you can hear, you got to have this ear on the side of your head to direct the sound into the eardrum. And then that eardrum's got little hairs and stuff on it, you know. And there's a lot to this thing of hearing. But we tend to oversimplify things, and this lady has oversimplified something, but she's got some basic truth here. She's not just whistling Dixie through a straw hat, and there's got to be a reason for this MCO. Listen, this manufacturer's certificate of origin is something you get with an automobile. Do you get it with an airplane? Do you get it with a big screen TV? Well, there's you know, some questions need to be asked and answered here. The answer is no, you don't. And Larry Beecraft said over here on the next page, you know, he said, now, this document was just simply created by international convention primarily for tax purposes. And as you can see, it is not the title of any object, not even for cars. Well, every car has an MCO. Most cars don't get shipped. Hey, every car that comes out of Detroit has an MCO. Most of those cars do not get shipped. They're not used in international trade or commerce. So why does the state of Colorado want that MCO? And, by the way, could I get the MCO? Has anybody ever done that? Has anybody ever walked into a car dealer and said, I want to buy a car, and I want the manufacturer's certificate of origin? Who gets the MCO, and why does the state get the MCO, but I don't? Well, I had five students that all went in and got the MCO and walked out with it. And there's a different outcome when you walk out of the dealer showroom with the manufacturer's certificate of origin, and you don't get a title issued by the state to the car. You'll get a different outcome, Mr. Beecraft. Now, the normal modality is you walk into the dealer and you say, I'd like to buy that car. And Beecraft explained it. And he's not lying to you. He explained it correctly. He just didn't have all the facts. The normal modality is you walk into the dealer and say, I want to buy that car. The dealer says, okay, that car is $20,000. Just write your check out. And you say, well, I don't have $20,000. The dealer says, that's no problem. You can pay us $300 a month for the next so many months. And here, sign here, and sign there. Now, this is a conditional sales contract. So, this is a different type of purchase now than if we walked in there and paid cash. Now, the dealer would like you to walk in there and pay him with a check. What if you walked in there and paid the dealer with gold coin? Because if you walked in and paid that dealer with gold coin, you'd have a different outcome than you would if you went in and paid him with a check, or you went in and bought it on a conditional sales contract. You get three different outcomes here. And that manufacturer's certificate of origin falls into somebody else's pocket, and you get a different response from the policeman out on the street. And I'll relate that to you. And then there's another part of the story out in California, where I had five students do this. Willie Brown, who at the time was the Speaker of the Assembly, introduced legislation to require the dealers to only give the MCO, the Manufacturer's Certificate of Origin, to the state, that the buyer of the automobile cannot have that document. Look, if that document is simply for tax purposes, or that document is simply for export, then why does Willie Brown introduce legislation to require the dealers in California to give that MCO only to the state? Why is it so important if it's not the title of document or the title document? See, I mean, these are questions that this lady has in her brain that Larry Beecraft does not have in his brain because he hasn't had that experience. But then this lady doesn't have the experience either. And so what this boils down to is both of them are talking off the top of their head, kind of shooting from the hip, don't have quite all the facts. I liked old Kent Hovind. Old Hovind one time was being chastised by an evolutionist. And this evolutionist was kind of making fun of him and saying, hey, you're out of touch with reality and suffering from the terminal stupids. And Hovind asked him, sir, do you know everything that there is to know in the world? Well, that's a pretty good question, because the answer is obviously no, and only a fool would answer yes. So the guy said, well, no, I don't know everything there is to know in the whole wide world. And he said, do you know half of everything that there is to know in the whole wide world? Well, only a fool would answer, yes, I know half of everything that there is to know. So the evolutionist said, well, no, I don't know half. And Hovind asked the closing question. He said, well, sir, could it be that what I'm telling you is a part of that half of everything that there is to know in the world that you haven't heard yet? So let me pose that as a postulate to all of you. Could it be that what I am disseminating to you is a part of that one half of everything in the world that there is to know that you have not heard yet? Partner? Now, I don't claim to know everything, but I know a little bit, and I'm god-awful good at the little bit that I do know. And with that, let me give you the mid-course reminder and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing or recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about freedom of speech, and we're zeroing in on a subject matter here called the Manufacturer Certificate of Origin as the backdrop, and that is not everybody agrees with everybody else at least 100% of the time on 100% of the subject matter. But that does not mean that the participants in the discussion here are total liars 100% of the time, or all crazy or total fools all of the time, or hell, even part of the time. So when Larry Beecraft uses the term crazy, I presume that that's a vernacular, that this is a poor argument, or that it's not correct, or it's flawed, or something like that. And he uses that term. I like to avoid that because it's got such a negative connotation to it. When somebody comes into law school, for instance, I had a doctor here one time in the recent past. He was from Texas and very knowledgeable, I'm sure, in his field. I mean, as a doctor, I mean, he knows his onions. And he's an allopathic physician, and he's a specialist, and he specializes in a particular kind of medicine. But does that mean that that doctor knows everything that there is to know about health? Does that doctor know how to cure cancer? I know of 14 cures to cancer. I had cancer on my jaw, and I cured it myself here at home. We're using one of those 14 modalities. My wife has had cancer for 30 years now, and she's still got it, and she's treating it with natural herbs and vitamins and so on. Now, I'm sure that the allopathic medical doctor would say, that's crazy. Well, I don't know. My wife has lived for 30 years with cancer. She's had this cancer now in one form or another in her body now for 30 years. Is she cured? No, I wouldn't call her cured, but she's not dead either. So she's kind of in a middle ground, wouldn't you say? Now, I don't know if I've got cancer in my body or not. I probably do. But the tumor that was on my jaw is gone. G-O-N, gone. Now, I'm not an expert. I'm not a gynecologist, you know. And I'm not a cancer expert. But, hey, listen, everybody's got this specialty, and the theory behind this is that if you've got a piece of paper on the wall over here, and you're one of these OBN gynecologists, you know that there isn't anything that you don't know, and I'd take exception to that. By God, my old granny had 7 babies, and I think she knew more about babies and childbirth than any gynecologist that ever drew breath. You know, that's just my opinion of it. Now, that old gal knew something about raising kids. She knew something about having babies, and she knew something about midwifery and so on. So the idea that you have to be some kind of paid professional, and we're all intimidated by lawyers, you know. Guy comes along, he's got a law degree. Oh, my God, this guy is next to God. He's just, you know, knows everything. And I'm sitting here saying, I don't believe that. I don't believe it for a minute. Just because you're a judge, you know, doesn't mean that you know everything that there is about law. And I can tell you that firsthand. I'm sitting in my office. My God, I'm surrounded by law books. I haven't read them all. Neither is any lawyer, neither is any judge. I haven't read them all. Might have read a bunch of them. Might have read more than me. They haven't read them all. They don't know everything. And see, this is the point I'm making. Nobody knows everything. And that's why freedom of speech is so important. Larry Becraft's views are very important because he knows something. And I want to know what he knows. But I also am aware of the fact that he doesn't know everything and that some of what he thinks he knows is in error. And vice versa. So what we're trying to do here in freedom of speech is to get all of the truth from one guy, mix all of the truth from that guy with this guy's truth over here, so that all of us have more truth than we have today. And that's what the adjudicatory process is about. See, when two adversaries come into court, the judge does not know who's right and who's wrong. He does not know who's telling the truth and who's lying. Both sides may be telling the truth. Has it ever occurred to you? Neither side is lying. An illustration of that comes up on the Hindenburg. When the Hindenburg caught fire and burned up, there was a newsreel photographer there, and they were taking pictures of it. They actually had the photograph when the fire broke out. And there were, I forgot now, at the hearings, I think there were 62 or 67 witnesses that all testified that the fire began at the rudder at the top of the blimp. Two witnesses testified that the fire began on the side of the Hindenburg, traveled to the rear, up to the rudder, and the conclusion was that the two witnesses were in error and that the 67 witnesses were telling the truth. And so, years and years later, I don't know, it was just a few years ago, there was a fella that worked for NASA. He was retired, and he was kind of interested in the Hindenburg. And he took the testimony of these two witnesses, and he got an actual sample from the wreckage of the Hindenburg's fabric. And he took it and analyzed it, and the Hindenburg had aluminum particles in the dope. See, when they put this fabric on the outside of the skeleton, it had this aluminum in it. Well, the dope and the aluminum is the same stuff that they use as solid rocket fuel. And come to find out, by forensic evidence, the Hindenburg caught fire by static electricity in the middle of the blimp on the starboard side, which traveled down the side in an electrical discharge and then up to the top. The 67 witnesses all told the truth, as far as they knew the truth, but they couldn't see the starboard side. They were all on the port side. They could not see where the fire originated. As a result of that inquest, we believed that there was a leak in the hydrogen cell inside, or that it had been sabotaged or something, and so on. And now, to this day, if you look up the Hindenburg, you'll find that it was either sabotaged or there was a leak in a fuel cell. That's not true. That is not what happened. Freedom of speech has not been impaired here. No government edict has come out and said, if you tell the truth about the origin of the Hindenburg fire, we're going to put you in prison. I'm not alleging that, but I'm telling you that you probably didn't know the truth about the Hindenburg because you didn't see the rest of the story, and that's my point. By utilizing free speech, we can come to a different understanding of an event such as the Hindenburg. I have a different take on the Hindenburg than the rest of you people have. And that's because I've seen the forensic evidence that was put out by the people at NASA, and because of that, it changed my view. I believed what I saw in the movie tone film also. It looked like to me that it started at the rudder, but then I couldn't see the other side of the blimp either. And there were only two guys that were sitting over in a hangar that could see that starboard side, and they're the ones that actually saw where the fire began. See, that was the question. Where did it begin? We knew that it was at the rudder. We knew that it was at the entire ship. We knew it was at the bow and the stern. But that was later. Where did it start? And that was the question. Now, going back here to this MSO, or there's MCO here, this lady goes on to say, now lying lawyers, DBA the state, claim ownership of your car, which is why your tags state for official use only. That way, the lying lawyers, DBA the state, can now regulate, fine for their own personal gain, and take their car whenever they want. Larry Beecraft says, no, that's not true, that when you have the title to the car, then you own the car. This lady's right. The state claims ownership of your car by virtue of that MCO. And they issue a certificate of title. It's not title to the car. It is a certificate of title. Go look at it again. How come it's a certificate and not the title itself? Now, there's a large body of law that deals with title. And so there's quite a little subject matter on title. That MCO is the superior title. And there's a story about title, and there's a story about superior title. And Larry Beecraft talks about an invisible bundle of rights. He's right. There is an invisible bundle of rights, and it's called the subject of property. And it is true. There can be multiple owners of the same piece of property. And Beecraft alluded to that. And the normal guy, the average Joe Sixpack, goes in, buys a car, comes out of the dealership, and drives it home. And his neighbor says, Tom, isn't that a new car? Yes, this is my new car. Oh, wow, Tom, that's really great. I'm so pleased to know that you now have a new car. Now, everybody refers to it as his new car, like we refer to our ears as the seat of hearing. Yeah, I heard you with my ear. No, you didn't. You didn't hear that guy with your ear. Your ear, boys and girls, is a slab of flesh stuck onto the side of your head. And your ear, that slab of flesh hanging on the side of your head, doesn't hear anything. That's just the way it is. And when Tom comes home with this new car, he does not own that new car. What Tom has is an equitable interest in that car. An equitable interest along with some other people, maybe the bank. and certainly he has an equitable interest with the state. Now, let me tell you about this equitable interest by the state. One day I was driving down the street with my automobile, and I didn't have any license plates on it. An officer Noble stopped me, and he made inquiry, and he said, "Sir, why don't you have license plates on your car?" And I said to Officer Noble, "Because this is my automobile, and the state does not own it. And because it's my automobile, I'm using my property. This automobile is my property." And Officer Noble, a nice man that he was, could not understand that. So he arrested me and hauled me off to jail, and he called a towing company and had my car towed away. Right? Now, let's put this shoe on the other foot. Got that story in mind? You got that shoe on your foot yet? Now, the police don't take your property out of your house. I mean, they don't come to your house and take your washing machine. If the policeman now was informed that this washing machine was stolen, he would not ask for the manufacturer's certificate of origin or the title. He would require that somebody prove that it was their washing machine before he would act to take it. And that's because you have a property right in your washing machine. But that policeman will take that automobile right off the street. Furthermore, watch this. You can pull that car up on private property. And then in Idaho, they wouldn't take the car off of private property, but they would take it off of public property. See, I've tested this driver's license, registration, and manufacturer's certificate of origin. I've been into the courts. Hell, I've been to the Supreme Court with it. I know a little. I don't know everything, but I know a little. See? And a lot of people haven't done that. Now, I took a case, this very case right here, Officer Noble took my car. Now, I've got the title to it, say. I've got the state-issued title to this car. I have a bill of sale that which was issued to me by the owner. There's no bank that owns anything to it. I got a bill of sale that says I've got an allodial estate in this automobile by the guy that said that he was giving me all of his right title and interest to it. I took it up to our state Supreme Court. Now, here's what the state Supreme Court of Idaho told me about ownership of an automobile. I walked in there and I said, "I've got this automobile." And the state Supreme Court said, "No, you don't." How do you like that? Larry Beecraft says, "Well, now, when you've got the title to this automobile, you own that car." I'm here to tell you, Mr. Beecraft, that taint so. Now, you may believe that you hear with your slab of flesh on the side of your head, and that's the common vernacular, and I understand that, but taint so. And you may believe that because you have a title and a bill of sale in your possession that you own that car, but you don't. You've got an equitable interest in it. That's a very valuable piece of ownership. I don't deny that. It is a part of your invisible bundle of rights. In the same nature as you went down and you rented a car from Hertz. And you parked your car outside of a building and you went inside and you're doing business. Now I come along. And I happen to recognize that car. And so I get in the car and I drive off in the car. And you call the police and say, "Listen, this guy George Gordon stole my car." And so the policeman stops me and he says, "Hey Gordon, what are you doing in Bob's car?" And I say, "This is not Bob's car. This car belongs to Hertz. And I took it. I don't deny I took it. I'm in possession of it." Bob comes along and says, "Wait a minute, Gordon stole my car." It is true. Bob has an equitable interest in that Hertz car. He paid rent. He signed a contract. Now, do we say Bob owns the car because he says it's my car? He has an invisible bundle of rights. He does have an equitable interest in the Hertz car, but he doesn't own it. Any more than you own your car, that you have a bundle of rights called a title. Now listen to what the state Supreme Court said to me. They said, if Mr. Gordon could prove that he owned the automobile in question, we would have a much different case before us. Now write that down, boys and girls. That's an important statement. If Gordon could prove that he owned the automobile, well, what in the hell proof do you want, court? You got the title. You got the bill of sale. You got my testimony. And the Supreme Court comes back and says, if Gordon could prove that he owned the automobile, we'd have a different case before us. Meanwhile, back on the farm, since Gordon doesn't own the automobile, then he doesn't have the rights that he's claiming to it, and particularly his right to operate the automobile as a piece of property on a public right-of-way. And then furthermore, I said that Officer Noble doesn't have a right to take my private property, and the court said, yes, he does. All right, let's try it this way. Let's suppose you go down and you rent a Hertz car, and you're paying the rent on it, and some time goes by, and then you stop paying the rent, just like you don't register your car, see, and you don't pay the rent. All right, so you park your car and you go into the building, and the Hertz people come along and they take their car. So you call the cops and you say, hey, somebody stole my car. The police go down to Hertz and they say, hey, we're looking for this car. And the Hertz guy says, yeah, it's right there on the lot. Does the cop then say, well, you stole Bob's car? No. First of all, you couldn't charge him with theft anyway because it's a civil issue. Hertz has simply come over here and taken their car. Now, Bob, if you have paid your rent, you may have a civil action against Hertz for breach of contract, but you never have an action against him for stealing the car. And that's because they own the car. Wait a minute. Does Hertz own the car? Does Hertz have the highest and best evidence of title? Does Hertz have the superior title? Well, they got superior title to you, Bob, but they don't have the superior title. Maybe the bank has superior title. Well, does the bank own the car? Well, gee, maybe the state has superior title. You know, and that's a subject matter called superior title. Write that down, boys and girls, because we're going to look at superior title here in a little bit. Now, the reason that this term, had Gordon been able to prove that he owned the car, we'd have a much different case before us, came from a case called McKenzie versus New York. That was the first place I'd ever seen that term. I'm pretty sure it was McKenzie versus New York, 1914. This guy, McKenzie, comes into the Supreme Court of New York in 1914, and he says, you cannot compel me to get a license to drive my automobile, because that automobile is my private property. The state Supreme Court comes back and says, oh, yeah, we can. Yeah, we can. We're going to do it under the police powers, and the reason we can do that is because the automobile is the unusual and extraordinary use of the public right-of-way. You might want to write that down. Unusual and extraordinary use. Unusual and extraordinary use. That can be regulated and controlled. Not the usual and ordinary, but the unusual and extraordinary can. So I'll give you an illustration of that. Let's suppose that you want to move a house down the road. Do you need a license or a permit to do that? I'm going to grant to you that you own the house and that the right-of-way is a public right-of-way. Do you have a right to use the public right-of-way to move your house down the street? And the answer is yes and no. You have a qualified right. You have a right to move your house down the street, but the time and place will be set by the state. And why is that? Under the police powers. The state has the power to regulate the time and place, time and use. Why is that? Because moving a house down the street is not a right to travel. It is a right to property, which you have, but it's not an inexhaustible right. It's not an unalienable right, because it's the unusual and extraordinary use of the road. Now, going back into this right to travel thing, you know, the courts have said, starting in 1867, I'll look this case up, I've forgotten the name of it right now, but the first time this came up was right after the Civil War, 1867. A state somewhere started taxing people who were traveling by stagecoach, and the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. You cannot tax people's right to travel. And that's because it's a property right, and we talked about this last week. You can't tax property in the United States of America, and nobody is taxing your labor. Your labor is a right. I showed you that last time, remember? You have a right to labor. You don't have a right to the automobile. You have a right to property. There isn't anybody in this country that owns an automobile. I say anybody. Ordinary persons in this country don't own automobiles. You cannot own another person. You're prohibited from owning people because of the 13th Amendment. There was a time in America when you could own an automobile. I mean, you could own it and it was your property. And Larry B. Kraft came up with a good point. He said, wait a minute, this title guarantees me a right to my automobile. There was a time in America when you could own it. There was a time in America when you could own another person. You could own a bondservant. You could own a slave. But not anymore. But that doesn't mean that people aren't owned. But you see, today only the state can own people. Remember, we've talked about that on this program. Only the state can own people now. And if you want to use somebody in your business, then you have to rent them from the state. And if you want to use an automobile, you have to rent it from the state. And the prima facie evidence that you don't own it is the registration that you pay every year on that automobile. Now, land ownership is another type of property that we like to point to and say with pride, well, I own this home. No, you don't. I own this farm. No, you don't. In fact, there's a statute in the Bible where God himself has reserved title to all of the land on planet Earth. There is no one who has ever owned one square foot of land on planet Earth. There's no one that owns one square foot of land on planet Earth today. But that doesn't mean forever, because God himself says there will come a time in the future when you may own real property, real estate, land on planet Earth. There is a time coming, but tain't here yet. But yet we call this property, and we say we've got a right to this property, that this is my property, this is real property. We have real and chattel property. We say, well, this is my real property. No, it isn't. And there's somebody else that has superior title to it. Well, hell, the county has superior title, the state has superior title, and God has superior title. So when you write down that word superior title, what we're saying is that there's a pecking order here. It's true that you've got some interest in this land, you've got some interest in this property, but that does not mean that you own it. And if you had a property right, you would have something different than an equitable interest. And when you have the MCO, you've got something different than the title. And we'll talk about that next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, which is what you're listening to, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.